Nana. Some people call me Mary Susan. Some people call me Lemon Street Sue, believe it or not. However, I am an alcoholic and I am wicked grateful to be sober. And this side of the daisies. Yesterday I wasn't. Today I am. So, and I'm also wicked grateful to Tisnua and to my friend Mark and all of you because this is my fourth Tisnua birthday. So it's really special to me. And even though it's 39 years of sobriety, ever since the pandemic, I've been hiding out over here in Tisnua with you guys. And it's a good thing. One of my favorite memories of it is back when they had the bubble bath meeting. I never stopped talking about that. They had a bubble bath meeting out of the kitchen one time. People actually took bubble baths. There was no flesh shown. Don't get nervous. It was just a lot of fun. And I was just, it just brought me out of my shell, anyways. And I got grew to love a great deal of people over there. The other reason why I love it is in sobriety, I found out that I was actually adopted by my grandparents. And I thought of them as mom and dad my whole life, though they were really old. And I couldn't understand why. How they could have had me at that age. I found out that my brother, who I thought was my brother, was really my dad. And he was a young teenager. And my mother was from, her people were all from Cork. And she was a young teenager too. So the family took me in. But they decided not to ever tell me, to just make as if I was my grandparents' kid. I guess that was some rule of my grandfather's. He said, "We'll adopt her, but she has to grow up thinking she's my little girl, or I'm not doing it." So it isn't that I wasn't loved. I was well loved. However, there was a lot of secrecy around me, and a lot of talk that would stop when I'd enter a room. A lot of things I never even thought about that were just automatic. And caused problems for me socially later on in life. I grew to be very, very shy. And I know today that for me, and this isn't for everybody, I happen to be of the school that believes I was born with alcoholism, the genes for it, and all it needed was the alcohol to activate it. And I believe it centers in my mind. I say this from my experience, and that no matter how long I've been sober, I could always end up drunk again if I picked up the first drink. So I have had no reason in 39 years to change my mind about that. I've seen too much. I've been to too many wakes and watched marriages dissolve and all sorts of things and kids' lives be ruined. And all because when somebody didn't know they were alcoholic or they knew and they couldn't do anything about it. And they'd pick up a drink and the drink it take a drink and then the drink would take their life. And I know I know that's what would happen to me. I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever. I will tell you this. I started out, I would call it a binge drinker, except it wasn't quite like long periods of time in between drinking. There were just short periods of time between drinks. And that time between drinks got shorter and shorter as the alcoholism progressed in me and as life went the way it did. I happened to come out of high school right smack dab into the 60s. And I went on the Magical Mystery Tour with a whole bunch of my friends. And before that, I was quiet, shy, a student, just wanted to go to college. I wanted to be a criminal psychologist, actually. And I knew where I wanted to go to school, and I only applied to one college. I got in on the strength of an essay. Wasn't because I was brilliant in school. My grades were average, and the reason they were average was I couldn't participate. If I was called upon to answer a question, I would freeze. I couldn't answer it, and it would seem I didn't know the answer, but I knew the answer. I just couldn't say it. I would literally not want anybody to look at me at all. Later on in life, somebody told me they thought I was a snob in high school. It wasn't that I was a snob. was that I was afraid. I had so much fear. I often had my head held down and hardly ever held it up. I was the person that sat there listening to everybody else's problems because I couldn't talk about myself at all. I didn't even know what to say about me. I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I knew there was something that wasn't quite right and I couldn't figure it out. And the only time I ever felt comfortable was once I had that first drink in me. I'll never forget it. It was my 18th birthday and we were outside in back of the school. Today, you'd probably end up with a felony for drinking on the school grounds. But anyways, we were out in the back and somebody got a case of beer. Now imagine your first time out, you get a case of beer. I wasn't nipping and sipping before this. This out of the gate, we got a case of beer. There was three of us and we drank those beers. And I was not falling down pissy ass drunk either. I felt like life just began, like the stars came out. I felt so free and it felt so good to be there. It was that aha moment I had and I would chase that feeling. I don't think I ever got it quite the same way ever again until I got sober, but I would chase after that freedom of being me for a long, long time. And I ended up at that school that I tried to get into that I told you I got accepted at. There was a party going on in the woods one day. And this is absolute truth. I was thinking about my friends being up in the woods of Burlington. I lived in Burlington, Massachusetts, which was mostly wooded at the time. And they were all up there and they were drinking and they had a big bonfire and I knew it. And I couldn't concentrate on where I was because I knew where my friends were. And I don't know, I was listening to the instructor and he was talking about cultural anthropology. And I thought, what do I need to listen to this for? And I left, went out to the car to smoke a joint to decide what to do. And decided, I'm going to the party. I can always come back to school. And I left and went to that party. Do you know, I never went back to Boston University as hard as I tried to get into it. I don't even know what happened to it. I can't honestly tell you why not. It just one place led to another place, led to another place. And within a year, I was out in California and LA, and that's where it was at. I was a flower child. I literally sold the free press, they called it, for a buck out in LA on the streets to get money to eat out there. And it was fine. I wasn't like homeless. I was out there on a journey. I was on an adventure. And I really did have flowers in my hair and a jug of wine by my side. And I couldn't have been happier. You know, when I look back in those days, to me, it was like being on a movie set. When I went down in LA and I saw all the stars on the sidewalk, you know, where they put the famous actors, they put all their names and stars on the sidewalk. I couldn't believe it. But on acid, it scared the living daylights out of me because I thought the palm trees were some kind of giant crabs that were coming down to get me. That's where I was at 18 years old. And I look at my 18-year-old grandson and I'm so grateful he isn't where I was. And I don't know, like the magic turned tragic pretty rapidly. I wasn't out there 3 months and I had no idea what happened to my Irish luggage, which was a big green bag of clothes that I brought with me because I couldn't be bothered packing back then. And I lost the bag somewhere. There were some people looking for me because some drugs got stolen. I didn't steal them, but I saw who did it and they knew I knew. And it was one of my friends that had come out there with me. And my life was in danger. They were not fooling around. And this older guy said, you remind me of my daughter in Boston. And he used to call me the Boston hippie. He said, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you get out of this. And he brought me out to his home out in the San Fernando Valley. And out there, it was very expansive property, very rich, nice. Nobody would find me there. And I couldn't even eat. I sat in a corner crying the whole time I was there. And he brought me down off. I think I had been on an acid trip for about 3 weeks at the time. And he brought me down off of it with some opium. And I know I didn't get addicted to it. It really did help me get off it. And he had me call home and try to find a way to get back to Boston. So to get me out of there. And I ended up with my husband at the time. I didn't get into that, but we were married for a short time. Vietnam ruined that. He was drafted, and the person that came back was not the person I married, but we remained friends throughout his life. He died in 2008 of a heart attack, but we weren't married all that time. We were only married a year. We were best friends, and it just seemed like the thing to do. And anyways, he came out there to get me, to rescue me. He was my rescuer, and he brought me home, and he got me off of stuff, and I became depressed without anything in my body. I stayed in my room in the dark, and I wouldn't come out of it. I very seldom ate, and my mother called my friend Sharon that I went to high school with, and she said, you need to get her out of the house because this is not healthy. Nobody should be in their room every day like that. She's really not even eating anything. So they said, okay, we'll get her tonight, and we'll bring her out with us. So friends loved it. They came. They brought me some black beauties and said, here, take these. That's speed, by the way, and you'll feel better. I took the black beauties, and I did feel better. I couldn't wait to get out, and out we went, and I was talking and living, and I got introduced to the world of bars, and we went there, and to me, that was the best place on the planet. That was like sober. I've been to the Grand Canyon, and there's nothing that beats seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time. And that's what it was like for me when I hit that bar room. The lights, the music, the people talking, watching them. I was a people watcher, and I would sit at the bar. That became my resting spot. I loved it. I'd sit there, talk to the bartender. I didn't have to wait for drinks. It was beautiful. And that's what I was doing. I met my second husband at a bar. My girlfriends thought he was cute, and they all wanted to dance with him. So I said, I'm going to marry that guy. I didn't know anything about him, but he drank with us, and we were all partying. We called it partying back then. And I wasn't working. I wasn't doing anything. My father was absolutely fed up with me. He didn't know what was wrong with me. Every now and then they'd bring me to a mental hospital to see if they could straighten me out and find out what my problem was. I'd have my friends bring me in pot, you know, and speed. Sometimes I'd get a pass and we'd go out and we'd do acid. And I think that was a hoot, go back to the hospital on acid and look at all the straights looking weird and freaky. And, you know, that, so it wasn't helping me any. I had a therapist who drove a Volkswagen that had flowers painted all over it. And she's asking me how much pot I smoke. And I sat there and said, are you kidding me? How much pot do you smoke? That did not go anywhere. That was a wasted trip. Nothing good happened there. And I just progressively got further and further away from reality and responsibility. I end up having a child I couldn't take care of. My mother took care of him most of the time. My father got even madder at me because I wasn't even taking care of the kids. So he laid down some rules and he said, you are not to leave this house unless that child is bathed and put to bed properly. Do not leave your mother with that responsibility. So I thought about that and I said, well, that's not too much to ask for. I'm a mother and I'm thinking this way. And I put the kid to bed and I'm off and I'm gone for 2 or 3 days at a time. That's what I mean by binge drinking. I would be off for 2 or 3 days at a time. Not like typical binge drinkers. We wouldn't even go home. And we drank until there was nothing more to drink and there was no more party to be had. I'd go home. Half the time I'd be stoned, laughing at my mother. Because she didn't know I was stoned. Thought they were from the old country. They stayed away from any. They had no clue. They didn't know what was wrong with America. I laugh because we feel that way now. But they didn't know what was wrong with America. And my father was just absolutely beside himself. Because girls didn't belong out after dark. And if you didn't have some purpose to be out there, you shouldn't be out there because bad things could happen to you. And I just thought, oh, he's such an old fuddy-duddy, you know. And my mother sometimes would get in collusion with me because she wanted me out of the house. She didn't want me in there depressed. She didn't know what else to do with me. She figured I was being young. She was Irish, so she put up with more drinking because her brothers all drank. And my father's people were not, didn't drink. They didn't drink in my house either. Anyways, it was allowed. And that was going along. And I had this, I ended up marrying that guy. And it wasn't too good because not even a few months later, I find out that I have married somebody that is incredibly abusive when he's drunk. And I have a shame inside of me. Because I'm trying to be a wife and a mother, and I'm trying not to drink and go out with my friends. So when I would do that, I'd have to give up everybody, because if I didn't, I knew that I would drink and I'd lose track of what I was doing and I'd get a beating. So I was trying really hard, and if I could have pulled myself up by the bootstraps and did things the way they did in my family, or even got back to my dreams and started a life for myself, it would have been when my daughter was born. My daughter was born multiply birth defective in 1974. And I wanted to keep her alive. I didn't drink for quite a while, maybe, well, for me, quite a while would have been 5 months or so, 6 months. I went to everything that they would could teach me about her. I went to the hospital. I studied up. I took all the training that they wanted to give me, anything to keep her alive. My husband, however, continued progressing in his alcoholism and in his incredible violent progression that he had. He, when I was pregnant with her, he threw me out a window because I think the towels weren't folded right or something. It was insane. And I hid all of this from my parents. I didn't want them worrying. I didn't want my family knowing. I felt deep shame and guilt. So I wasn't one that had telephonitis when I drank. I kept everything to myself, and I tried not to let them know. When I was around the family, I'd act as if everything was okay. And nothing was okay. And my kids, though I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home, my kids grew up in one. And this is the kind of home life they lived. He was either throwing something out the window, me or other things, or smashing things, or just plain, just horrible. Set my hair on fire one time. Or I, the alcoholic who drank quietly and more into the bottle than out, would just lay on the floor crying. So they either had this heap of a mess on the floor for a mother, or they had this proactive, I call him proactive alcoholic who liked to smash things. And there was absolutely no sanity because what would happen is I would convince him to go on vacation and buy things for the kids as if everything was normal. I normalized that abuse for those children. They grew up in that it was normal to them. For the turkey to go out the window, you know, and I just clean it up and we would just go on as if nothing happened. So my oldest boy took the worst of it. He still has problems to this day because of it, because he was the one that got between us and he was the one that quieted down the drunk and picked up his mother and made her feel better and helped us get to safety. One day he said to me, I just have one question, Mom. He was 12. Why are we always out here and he's in there? We were hiding in trash cans so he wouldn't find us because he was on a tear. And I said, I don't know. And I started thinking about that. I did have a moment of clarity and I knew he was right. And I also, at the time, had a friend that I used to work with, and she kept trying to tell me to go to this agency called HAWC. In Massachusetts, it's help for abused women and children. And I did finally go. It took a while, but it took some more things escalating, I won't get into. But I did finally go. And I did finally get in a shelter. And I got home and he got out, and the courts evicted him. And I can't say he totally stayed away because he didn't, but mostly we were safe. Now you would think at this point I could have turned around and said, "Well, I'm going to straighten my life out now. I'm going to do." No, the first thought I had was, "Wow, this is great. I can go down the club and go dancing and not have to worry that he's following me." That was what went into my head. So I would put the kids to bed and I'd say to the oldest, "Watch them. I'm going out to relax for a little while." That's what I would say. I'm going out to relax. And I was going out to relax. But what sort of happened once I took the drink, I didn't remember to go back home. And I'd be at the bar till the bar closed. And then I'd be at the after party. Then I'd be walking on the streets, dead up drunk, falling down all over the place. And the kids would be home alone because the 15-year-old, he's now 15 at the time, figured out that, oh, when mom's not around, I can drink and drug. So that's what he was doing. So basically, we had a little kid. He's 5 years younger than Dee. Dee was, unable to walk without the aid of a walker and braces. And so she was at home crawling around with her younger brother. And the older one was off with his friends, or his friends were there. This is the life I lived. And in this condition, I first went to Overeaters Anonymous, and I was not eating. And I probably weighed about 121 pounds at the time. And I went there because I thought food was my problem. I had bouts of anorexia. And so when I would be trying to control my life, I would sink into the anorexia. And I thought, well, I got to get out of this anorexia because I'm not eating. So I'm going to go to this thing. So I went to it. And it did help for a little while. I can't say it didn't. However, they were trying to tell me not to drink, that it was not a good idea to be drinking and trying to do Overeaters Anonymous at the same time, that it literally had calories and went against everything they were teaching. And I was like, well, whatever, somebody got to go out and enjoy myself somehow. So anyways, I continued on down that road. And in 1985, oh yeah, I left OA because I was going to the bar and it was interfering with going to the meetings. And eventually the bar won out because I couldn't be bothered going to the meetings. And besides, they were right. I wasn't even fat. I wasn't even eating. I was drinking. I was anorexic and absolutely 100% progressed alcoholic who couldn't breathe in and out sober. And I had pancreatitis and my stomach was a little bit swollen from it. And I had no idea. I didn't feel pain. I didn't feel hot. I didn't feel cold. My hypothalamus was being affected. I wasn't paying the bills. My landlord wanted me out. I had my phone shut off so the bill collectors wouldn't bother me. And my kid wasn't going to school, so they put him in a protective thing, and my oldest one, and they put him in an adolescent program so he could finish school. And my daughter went to a school for disabled kids and came home on the weekends. And this just freed me up to drink even more. That's all it did. But I would have great plans. I would think, oh, I'm going to join this gym. I bought a long distance bike ride, Raleigh, and I was riding bikes. In between things, I would try to do something normal. But the drink would always win out. Once I had the thought of a drink, I had no defense against it, absolutely none. I went back to school. It was just a disaster. It was a disaster. But little by slow, I got sicker and sicker, and I needed to. The day that I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous was December 13th, 1985. I went there to get somebody off my back. I did not go there to get sober. I went there to prove I didn't need to go there. And I'm leaving out a whole bunch of stuff I could tell you, but you can catch me at some other meeting. I might be talking about it. I had a career. I gave that up for a drink. There wasn't anything alcohol didn't take away from me, even my ability to take care of my daughter, that I would take a bullet for, even to this day. And I did not see that. If you confronted me, I'd say, "You're full of shit." Those were fighting words. "Of course I've been down. What are you talking about?" You know, my son tried to tell me that I hadn't bought food. I said, "Of course I did. You kids just ate it. That's all." I hadn't gone and bought food. I had gone to buy food. That was true. But I got to the aisle where they sold the beer and wine, and where do you think the money went? But just in case anybody came over, I had to stock up. Nobody was coming over except once in a while, some barroom asshole followed me home and had his way with me and left like I was a piece of trash. That's where my life went. Anyways, I went to the meeting, and believe it or not, at that meeting, I wanted to prove to them I didn't need to be there, so I didn't drink. This woman said to me, "Do you think you can stay away from alcohol for the next 24 hours?" I said, "Oh, you think I'm here because I need to be here? No, you know what? I can do it, no problem." And guess what? I couldn't stay away from alcohol a half hour, never mind 24 hours, or I'd start detoxing and going into the heebie-jeebies. Not everybody gets to that condition anymore, but I was there. And I got to my, I'm at my apartment. I'm trying not to drink. I've got alcohol everywhere. It's killing me. I want to drink it so bad. And I'm shocked at how much I want to drink it. But I call her and I say to her, "I think somebody's in my apartment. I'm not thinking of drinking, but could you come over and just make sure I'm safe?" She says, "Sure." So she come over and she looks around. The kids are in bed. And there's alcohol everywhere, all over the place, the counters, the refrigerator. She says, "Well, there's nobody in here, but what are you doing with all this booze here?" And I said, "Well, I'm not going to drink that." She said, "Well, what do you got it for then?" I said, "Well, in case somebody comes over." "Why, have people been coming over?" I said, "Well, no, but they could." And she said, "Well, if you don't want to drink it, I suggest we throw it down the toilet." And I was like, "Holy shit, what have I done? I got this weirdo in my house wanting to throw this alcohol down the toilet." And I say, "What are we going to do that for?" She said, "But just, you know, let's just dump it down the toilet." So I figured the only way to get her out of the house is to let her do that. And then I would never let her back in, and I'd never go back to one of those meetings because they had crazy people there. And I go in the bathroom with her, and she says, "No, here, you pour it." And I said, "Me? I'm not the one that wants to get rid of it." And then I laid on the floor crying while she poured the booze down the toilet. I'm bawling my eyes out on the floor because the alcohol's going down the toilet and I don't think I have a problem. And she stayed. And I'm grateful to this day that she did because I started to go into horrible detox condition. She knew I would. She showered me. She made tea. She helped me get through the night. She told me if I didn't put a drink in my body, I would never have to go through this again. But that it wasn't going to be easy. It was going to be hard. And I was going to have to suffer my way through it. And she'd be at the meeting tomorrow. If I come to the noontime meeting, she'd either give me a ride there or a ride back, but she wasn't carting my ass all over the place. And I had been walking to bars all over the place, and it was winter, and I didn't care anyways. I didn't want to ever get in her car. I just wanted to get rid of her. But I went to the meeting because I didn't want her to come look for me. So you don't always have to have a desire to stay away from a drink, let me tell you. I just didn't want her to come looking for me. But while I was at the meeting, there were these guys there that were heavy hitters, and they were talking about the condition I was in. They were talking about how when they got to Alcoholics Anonymous, how they suffered, how they went through these the heebie-jeebies, how they were vomiting, couldn't put food in their body, didn't think they could live through it. And I'm sitting there like, "Holy shit, I don't want to be like these people. That's me. I don't want to be like these people." But I was captivated by them. And I couldn't take my eyes or ears off of them. I didn't like them, especially the asshole that had said to me, "It isn't pretty where booze and drugs took you, is it?" And I think, "You old bastard, get away from me." But I watched him every meeting he went to, and every time he put his hand up, I'd hear his voice when I was walking home trying to get away from them. And I'd say, you know what? They're brainwashing me there. I said that one day, and they said, well, your brain needs a washing. They always had some smart ass answer, and it was good for me. Somebody else, it might not be. And they were gentle with the people that needed them to be gentle. But I was a street drinker, and I was near death. They knew what they were doing, and they helped me. And I'll be forever grateful for all of them that helped me. I don't have the time to list that. It's got to be 1,000 people. There's hundreds of people that have made me stay another minute longer, another 10 minutes longer, another hour longer, another situation longer, another day longer, to just give it a try. I could always pick up the drink later if I wanted to. They'd say, nobody's trying to take your right to drink away from you. That's up to you. If you don't want to drink, we're here to help you, but we're not here to take the drink away from you. And that was odd to me. They got me with that. I had nowhere to turn on to get away from them. Everything I was using as an argument to leave. Now, I'll get to the God part. I was too sick to think about God, and I didn't hear any, and it doesn't matter to me. It didn't matter to me what people were saying anyways. This is what I was thinking. They're just trying to get me not to drink, and I don't have a problem, and I don't even know why I'm listening to these people. So whatever they were doing and saying about that, I believe everybody that says what they say. But for me, I was sick from booze. I was very booze sick, and they were kind. And they got me a half a cup of coffee. My hands would be shaking. Or they give me a little chocolate candy kiss that I could put in my, it took me a while to be able to put food. I had pancreatitis, didn't know it. And I got run out of town. My landlord had enough of my shit. So I had to leave. So some AA people helped me sneak out in the middle of the night. And they got my stuff in storage for me, and I end up in the welfare motel in the area where I now live. And in that motel was the most frightening time of my life. And I did have a big book. I hadn't read it yet, but I held on to it at night saying, just don't drink, just don't drink, just don't drink. In the back of that motel was a pool room, and all the other welfare mothers were going over there and hooking up with guys to get out of there. And I knew I could do it, and I could get a drink, and it was so hard not to. I was laying there with my kid. He's 45 now. He was 7 years old, and he was sleeping next to me. And in the morning, when we'd wake up, he'd get to go up to the front desk and get a donut for breakfast, and he'd pick me out one and bring it back and say, here's a donut, Mom. And to him, he was in heaven. He was having donuts for breakfast. But later, when I tried to take him to the soup kitchens to eat, he begged me not to do that anymore, that it scared him. I'm lucky I found a club, a sober club, and some of my friends from the North Shore that are here know it, the Graycroft. I got up to the Graycroft, and there was this guy, Lester, with the wooden leg, they called him. And he gave me a key to the Graycroft, and they had a kitchen, and they had food in there. And he'd say, just come up here with that kid and make yourself something to eat. There's usually somebody cooking up here anyways. Just come on up. You can hang out here as much as you want. Don't tell anybody I gave you the key. Keep it a secret. Well, he had given out keys to lots of people, but I thought I was special. And there was this other guy that he died drinking. He was sober at the time, but he couldn't hold on to it. And he bought my kid a winter coat because I had nothing. I was destitute. And I cried my eyes out for days because somebody was kind enough to get that kid out. And it shamed me at the same time because I was becoming sober and aware of what I wasn't doing and what I hadn't been doing. And I was caught up in that and very depressed over it. I wanted to die. I wanted to die every single day. I didn't want to be me anymore. And other people that were sober a long time and say, it's going to be all right. It's going to get better. You'll see. Or they talk about how the thing that got better was them. That maybe things didn't get better, but they got better. And I started to have a little hope that maybe I could do life. Maybe I could be a mom. Maybe I could take care of these kids. Maybe I could keep us safe. And you know what? Little by slow, I learned how to do all of those things. Not right away. Little by slow, made lots of mistakes. I'm going to close with this. I used to beat myself up over the things I couldn't do. Or I'd beat myself up over the stuff I was still doing that other people were talking about being sick. Oh, you know, that sick behavior. And there was this guy, Giorgio. And Giorgio would give me a ride home from the meeting sometimes. I'd be driving people crazy because I was trying to put the oldest kid out because he was using. And I'd put him out and I'd bring him back and I'd put him out and bring him back. And I'd drive the people crazy saying, I need to put him out. I need to get it. Whatever. And Giorgio gave me a ride home and I'm crying. I said, when am I going to ever just keep him out? I can't live like this. He's stealing from me. And Giorgio said, you're going to do every motherfucking thing you have to do till you can't motherfucking do it another motherfucking moment. And when that moment comes, you'll stop doing it. And then you'll start to get better. No, just don't get discouraged. And I go in the house and I thought, he's nuts. But you know what I found out? It's true. Whether I like it or not, it's absolutely true. I've had to do everything I've had to do until I couldn't do it another moment longer. Every single thing. And then when I got sick and tired of being sick and tired, I surrendered. And surrender is not a bad word for me. I surrendered that I needed help. That's all that means to me. I found ways to make words mean things that I could use them, so they wouldn't hurt me. Those steps people argue about, well, I used them against myself. There's no doubt about it. I took a baseball bat out and hit myself over the head with it. But I was participating nonetheless, and my brain was still sick. I was still sick, and I was still living sick. And what they did was they helped me to talk about that, which relieved some of the guilt and the shame that I was carrying around that was going to kill me. Never mind. I don't know if it would have made me drink or not, but I would have definitely been dead. And then when people did shoot themselves, and I had a good friend that did that, or sit on the railroad tracks, and I had a good friend that did that, I had people die of overdoses. I woke up and said, oh, wait a minute, this disease, wow, I got to be careful. I got the same thing they got, and I got the same thinking. So when I share in what you people call traditional meetings, I'm a secular member of AA. I don't split it. I don't do that to me. It's all AA to me. I'm a secular member. I can hold my head up and say that. Nobody can take it from me. If I got to put up with them, they got to put up with me. That's how I figure it. And was I always like that? No. I held my head in shame. I kept quiet. And it wasn't because of them. It was because my mother, who's dead in the grave, I thought she was going to roll over in her grave if I ever said I was an atheist. I thought I was shaming her. It had nothing to do with what was going on around me. But the day that I was able to be me and say, I'm an atheist, it freed me. And it allowed me to be more true to my own self. I know I'm a good enough mother, and I'm an absolutely great nana, and I'm sober, and that's why I can say that. And I have no doubt in my mind that that could change in a heartbeat. All I'd have to do is fall into a pit of despair and think a drink was the answer. So I come to AA to be reminded that a drink is not the answer, and to help people know that you too can get sober if you just do whatever you got to do and hang on tight. Because this disease will take you on a roller coaster. There's no doubt about it. Lots of people come in that are not alcoholic. They have substance abuse disorder, and they're welcome too. And who knows what they would become if they continued drinking. You have no way to know. Alcoholism is a very progressive illness, and just because it's this way now doesn't mean it'll be that way later. So you hang in there. I want people to be able to breathe in and out sober. And my heart is always open to anybody that needs to share their heart. Thank you for listening.
Thanks.